Once a year on this campus, we have our annual Wenchel Lecture. This is an endowed lecture that is focused on the area of homiletics. And this year, we are pleased to have with us as our Wenchel Lecturer, Dr. Thomas Long. Dr. Long earned an A.B. in chemistry from Erskine College in 1968. In 1971, his Master Divinity degree from Erskine Theological Seminary. You can explain that combination. And then in 1980, a Ph.D. from Princeton Theological Seminary. Since 1989, he has served as the Francis Landy Patton Professor of Preaching and Worship at Princeton Seminary. He has numerous professional activities that he is involved in. He's the editor of Theology Today and the senior homiletics editor for the New Interpreter's Bible. He's written 9 books. My guess is some of you have read some of his books. They're used as textbooks here. The Witness of Preaching and Preaching in the Literary Forms of the Bible. 9 books, 34 journal articles. And I would add that Dr. Long is one of the men in this nation now that is on the cutting edge of homiletics and is opening new doors with his insights for homileticians throughout the church in the United States. We are very honored and pleased to have with us Dr. Thomas Long.
Well, what a privilege to be on this campus and an honor to be a part of this very distinguished series of lectures. I want to talk today about the life to come, preaching on hope and with hope. And that means I'm going to be talking not so much about technique in preaching, but the content of what we preach. Every time I put myself in this kind of position, I am reminded and chastened by an experience that my boss, Tom Gillespie, who is the president of Princeton Seminary, had. He used to be a parish minister before he became president of the seminary. One day he was in his study and his secretary called him over the intercom. There's someone here to see you. That was their code for don't ask. So he said, send them in. She escorted into his office a 5-year-old girl, daughter of members of the congregation. She was dressed to the nines. The secretary said, she has a theological question for you. Well, Tom knew how to handle children. He squatted down and put his hands on her little shoulders and said, what's on your mind, honey? She said, what are we going to eat in heaven? Tom has a PhD in New Testament, but nothing in his training had prepared him for that question. He panicked. Finally, his mind seized on a line from the Apostle Paul, and he said with some relief, here on earth we have physical bodies, and God gives us physical food. But when we get to heaven, we're going to have spiritual bodies, and God will give us spiritual food. Thank you, she said, exited his office, and as she walked past the secretary's desk, she leaned over and said, he doesn't know either. So at that risk, here we go. A couple of weeks ago, I was back in my hometown of Atlanta, Georgia, to visit my aging parents for the Thanksgiving holiday. Good day I had with them, a day of family and food and football. But by Thanksgiving evening, I was ready for something else. And I noticed in the Atlanta paper an announcement that Rich's Department Store would be holding the 48th annual lighting of the Great Christmas Tree. Well, I remembered that because when I was a boy in the late 50s and a young teenager in the early 60s, I went to the lighting of the Great Christmas Tree almost every year. I hadn't been in 30 years or more, but it was a good night, the weather was good, I saw it in the paper, and so I went. Now, back in the old days, the way this happened was, Rich's would erect a colossal Christmas tree, 75 feet tall, on the top of its downtown store. And on Thanksgiving evening, thousands of people would gather on the street below. Now remember, this was in the late 50s and early 60s. The civil rights movement was at its peak. But nonetheless, black and white, young and old, rich and poor, city people and country people would gather on the street, united by a common mood, a common purpose, a common hope, to celebrate the beginning of Christmas and the wonder of the Christ child. As a matter of fact, the event would always begin spontaneously. Someone would start a Christmas carol, Silent Night, O Little Town of Bethlehem, and it would ripple through the crowd in the streets as everybody joined in. Then at the appointed hour, spotlights would flash on top of the store, and there would be a robed choir from one of the local churches, Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, Lutheran. That was the signal. Parents would pick up their children and put them on their shoulders so that they could see and hear what was about to begin. And the choir would burst into song, Joy to the World, O Come All Ye Faithful. Then the spotlights would illumine a second choir, CME, AME, and it would sing, Go Tell It on the Mountain. And then choir after choir after choir, until like the sky over Bethlehem that night, the whole host of heaven was singing. We would grow still as the night moved toward its climax. That came when a single spotlight illuminated a lone soloist, and he would begin, O holy night, the stars were brightly shining. Some heads would go up and see that the stars were still brightly shining on us. And then he would move to the crescendo, O night divine, and somebody would throw a switch. And the great Christmas tree would flame up in beautiful splendor, reds and golds and green lights topped by a magnificent star. O night divine. That, at least, is how I remembered it. And then I went back to this place of childhood wonder, and things have changed. For one thing, Rich's department store, like a lot of merchants, has exited from downtown, gone to the lucrative suburbs, and so even the host had to commute into the city for the event. Not only that, after a series of Supreme Court decisions and awkward social changes, Rich's has become a postmodern department store, sensitive to cultural pluralism and aware of the fact that religion, real religion, can alienate and be divisive. So the 1995 version of The Lighting of the Great Tree did not begin with Silent Night and O Little Town of Bethlehem, but with the mayor of Atlanta giving a rousing cheerleading speech about, we're in a city great enough to host the Olympics. And then when the Klieg lights finally came on, they did not come onto a robed choir singing Joy to the World. They came onto a gaggle of actors and actresses. One was dressed as a bear, another as Barney, the rest as Las Vegas dancers, and they soft-shoed their way through a saccharine version of the Teddy Bear's Christmas. The next act was Elvis impersonators who hubba-hubbaed through Jingle Bell Rock. While that was going on, I surveyed the crowd. Bored and restless children were pulling their parents toward the street vendors who were selling novelties and candy bars. Blacks and whites were there, but they stood in uneasy clumps, a post-OJ awareness that we see the world differently, keeping us apart. Knots of teenagers wandered their way restlessly through the crowd. One group was flipping quarters on the curb. Another young man with a baseball cap turned around backwards, pushed a willing young woman up against a light pole for a deep and hungry kiss. My nostalgic memories were in peril. I had recalled a community with a common faith, a common hope, at least a common text. But my memory of a reverent crowd at the foot of the tree evaporated. We were more like the crowd at the foot of the cross, jostling, confused, muttering, gambling, spitting, roiling in rival directions. Almost as an afterthought, a church choir finally did sing, a chorus from Handel's Messiah. But the irony was very thick, especially when they announced over the crowd, and the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all flesh will see it together. Well, there we were out on the street, all flesh, to be sure, a boiling pot of leisure and lust, contradictions and convulsions, but it seemed to me that the truest thing that could be said about us that night was that with the possible exception of the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl, we were not going to see anything together, least of all, the glory of the Lord. Now, be assured, I am not interested in holding a requiem today for my nostalgia. The lighting of the great tree was probably never as sweet and holy as I remember it. And anyway, it is not Rich's or Macy's or Marshall Field's job to hold public church and preach the gospel. That's my job and yours. And that's what concerns me today. But when that choir sang those words from Isaiah, "And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together," be assured, whether they knew it or not, they were proclaiming eschatology, the promise of the gospel to the whole creation and to all flesh about the future of creation. And they were proclaiming it in just the right place in the public square, for eschatology is news about the destiny of the whole world. Over this seething sea of humanity, they were singing the eschatological hope that our common human destiny is not disorder but reconciliation, not despair but the glory of God, that we will, all of us, red and yellow, black and white, young and old, rich and poor, see it together. As the theologian Daniel Migliori puts it, Christian faith is expectant faith. It eagerly awaits the completion of the creative and redemptive activity of God. "And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together." Or will it? Those words hung over the human clutter last Thanksgiving in a way that seemed unreachable, implausible, even absurd. We have lost in our culture our eschatological confidence, which is another way that we of saying that we have lost, in any profound Christian sense, our hope. As C.P. Snow has put it, "I think the signs are all pointing in the wrong way. The objective grounds for hope have gotten less, and the objective grounds for non-hope have gotten stronger." That does not mean, by the way, that we do not mourn our sense of the loss of hope. I was in South Africa 2 summers ago, right before the great April elections that lifted Nelson Mandela to the presidency and ended apartheid. And there was a kind of political hope going, but underneath there was a struggle to maintain real hope. I talked to one AIDS physician. He works in a hospital in Johannesburg, and he gets up every morning without any cure. And he faces a statistic of free fall, an epidemic of major proportions of AIDS in Africa. And I ask him, "How did you get up every day and do that?" He said, "I am clinging to the possibility of hope." I talked to a South African theologian, and I said, "How do you think it's going to go?" He said, "I've read what the American press said. We know that the Wall Street Journal has analyzed our economy, and it's too fragile to support democracy. We know that the New York Times has looked at the political situation and found it too volatile to endure. But as Christians, we cannot give up our hope." I'm clinging to the possibility of hope. As Christians, we cannot give up our hope. "And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together." This hunger for hope in church and culture makes it all the more unfortunate that the church's witness has become muted precisely on this theme and precisely at this point. We have become confused and silent as preachers about what George Caird has called the central understanding of biblical thought. We're in danger of losing our eschatological voice. Why? Part of the problem is embarrassment. I mean, we know as preachers and as theologians that one of our responsibilities is saying something about the gospel that is coherent to the intellectual framework of our time. But the problem is, the New Testament insists on speaking of its eschatology in raw and unmediated ways that will not process into the intellectual climate of our time. It insists on saying things like, "The sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." There's something about that kind of language that can't be smoothed out. You can't turn it into, "Smile, God loves you, have a nice day." No, the stars will fall from heaven, and most polite, educated Christians with at least an ounce of cultural sophistication would just as soon sweep that kind of language into the fundamentalist closet and lock the door and be done with it. As a matter of fact, Chris Becker, who has been here to lecture and who taught New Testament for many years on our faculty, when he was doing research for his book on Paul's apocalyptic gospel, he ran into this exchange in the denominational magazine of the Presbyterians that reveals some of our embarrassment about this language. It's a question and answer column. The subscribers can write in questions and the editors answer, and here was a question. Why are there so few sermons in our churches on the second coming? Is this part of our belief or not? Good question. Here's the answer. Not all Christians think alike on matters of theology, but it would be hard for someone to feel at home in our tradition who did not understand God as the one who has come, who is present, and who is yet to come in whatever form the future winds up taking. To literalize the second coming is to ruin its beauty. To ignore it is to avoid what may be the most important part of the gospel we know about, since the past and present, relatively speaking, are brief, but tomorrow borders on forever. In a follow-up letter, another reader wrote, "I compliment the editor for his elusive non-answer to what I am sure was a serious question concerning the second coming. If I understood his answer, he said, in effect, we don't all agree, but if you want to be comfortable in our church, you'll need to agree that Jesus is coming again, but not really. If you actually believe in the second coming, you'll ruin its beauty and significance, but you can't ignore it because it's in the future. Why not a simple answer? Now look, there are reasons, of course, to be embarrassed about the use of eschatological language. Phil Graham is using it in his fundraising letters for his presidential campaign. James Watt, when he was Secretary of the Interior, used it as an excuse to sell off precious government lands to strip miners because who cares about it? I mean, Jesus is coming again soon. That's enough to make any of us hang our heads in shame and to clothe our mouths about eschatology. But I want to suggest that there is something about our silence on eschatology that has a deeper motivation. I think somewhere in our bones we realize that it is our eschatology above all that throws us into conflict with the culture. If you want to know what puts us in conflict with the culture, it's not our decency, not our good citizenship, not our sweet thoughts. It's our eschatology. Do you remember that wonderful scene in the book of Acts when the Jewish officials, the religious officials, have arrested Paul? They've arrested him because he's an agitator. His preaching has disturbed the peace. They actually want to make it a capital offense and put him to death, but they can't do that. That takes the Romans, so they turn him over to the Roman authorities, who are utterly confused by the whole matter. They keep passing his case on to one judge after another until at one point it arrives before King Agrippa. Festus, the governor, is trying to explain this to Agrippa, and he says, "I don't know, they brought him here with these charges. It's a Jewish thing. I don't understand it." And at that point, King Agrippa turns to Paul. "Speak for yourself." And Paul speaks for every Christian preacher. "I stand here," he said, "on trial for hope." He knew that his real offense was not sedition or blasphemy or militating against the temple, but hope, preaching hope. It was not his agitation that disturbed the peace. It was his eschatology. It's on this matter of hope that the gospel most confronts the powers that hold sway, and therefore it is a matter of absolute urgency for those of us who preach to reclaim our eschatological voice, to know what the gospel says about hope, and to be willing to stand up in pulpit and sanctuary and public place and go on trial for hope. Indeed, Moltmann puts it right when he says, "Whenever the church loses its eschatology, it becomes a civil religion." I've always been intrigued that in Jesus' parable of the householder in the Gospel of Matthew, where the slave is left in charge of the house, read leadership left in charge of the church, it's when the slave begins to lose his eschatology, "My master will be delayed," that the trouble begins. And you would normally think that when a slave said, "My boss isn't coming back," that he would lay down his broom and take a nap. But instead, he begins to engage in acts of violence against the other members of the household. That's a key that even Matthew understood, maybe especially Matthew understood. When a church loses its eschatology, it loses its mission and begins to commit acts of violence against itself. Maybe our clobbering of each other over doctrine and polity and program is because we have lost our eschatology. But what is our eschatology? What is the gospel of hope? What does it mean? In a very helpful essay, the theologian John Macquarie has outlined three primary ways that eschatology has been understood in the history of the Christian tradition. Briefly, let me tell you what they are. First, there is what Macquarie calls futuristic eschatology. Futuristic eschatology, which he thinks is the most dramatic and mythological form of it. Briefly put, what futuristic eschatology says is, this world is doomed. There's coming a day in the future when this world and all human history will end. This old world's going to reel and rock. And Jesus will appear as judge and Lord on the clouds to bring before the judgment bar all human beings and all history. Macquarie connects this, by the way, most of all with the synoptic gospels. I think he's partially right there, but for reasons I hope to show later, I think he misunderstands some of the impulses in the synoptics. But if you take it at face value, futuristic eschatology has two problems, credibility and ethics. First of all, credibility. I mean, it's one thing to live for a few years in the acute expectation that the end will come, but the clock has now been ticking for 20 centuries, and even the boldest among us have difficulty maintaining an Advent edge after all that time. John Updike, in his novel Rabbit is Rich, speaks of a certain wimpy minister as something of a card, probably the best way to play it at this late date AD. You lose your edge. But in terms of ethics, futuristic eschatology says too little about the care of the earth. I mean, when we are looking forward to the city whose builder and maker is God, it is too easy to ignore the cities of terrible trouble in which we actually live today. Indeed, it was the failure of the futuristic eschatology to hold its grip on the imagination of the church that led to the second form of eschatology that Macquarie lists, and that's realized eschatology. Realized eschatology. Now, futuristic eschatology says the world is going to end. Well, so does realized eschatology, with this exception. Instead of it will end, realized eschatology says it's already happened. In the life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the world and all human history received its sentence of death. And the believing community already lives in the full manifestation of the presence of God's kingdom. Now, if you believe in futuristic eschatology, you stand up on your tiptoes and you look over the horizon for the coming of God in the future. If you believe in realized eschatology, you don't look over the horizon. You look all around you for epiphanies. Now, Macquarie connects that to the Gospel of John, and it is true that John, on balance, has more realized eschatology motifs in it than does the synoptics. One way to put it is, if the synoptic gospels think about the kingdom of God as in the future, John reaches out and grabs that future kingdom and pulls it as a canopy over ordinary time. So that if you want to know when the kingdom is coming in the synoptics, it's coming in the future. We're marching to Zion, beautiful, beautiful Zion. If you want to know where the kingdom is in John, it's above. And like a sewing machine, it keeps spiking down into ordinary time as sign. You can see that in the story of Lazarus. Lazarus is dead. Jesus is in a holding pattern outside of Bethany. Lazarus' two sisters come to him, Martha and Mary, and Martha says, "If you had been here, our brother would not have died. To which Jesus responds, your brother will rise. And Martha says, I know that he will rise in the resurrection at the last day. And Jesus says, no, no, Martha, that's the Gospel of Matthew. This is the Gospel of John. I am the resurrection and the life. Epiphany, manifestation of the kingdom here and now. The problem with realized eschatology is that in terms of the power of God to redeem society, it's something of a fizzled firecracker. Crime, sin, death, there's still growth industries. Where is this kingdom? As John Macquarie himself says, I think we must frankly say that if that was the end, and this is the new age, and it's all happened, it doesn't seem to amount to very much. If eschatology has been realized, well, it's rather a damp squib. But at least it was plausible to the contemporary mind, and that led to a modification of realized eschatology that takes the third form of eschatology that Macquarie talks about, and this is demythologized eschatology. Now, even though the architect of this, Rudolf Bultmann, is no longer the rage in theological circles, I think that demythologized eschatology, if there's any eschatology left in the mainline pulpit, it's generally this form of it. Now, what is demythologized eschatology? If futuristic eschatology said the world would end in the future, and realized says, oh no, it ended in the past, demythologized says, it's neither the future nor the past. It ends every moment in the present. Every moment is potentially an eschatological moment. Now, every time you hear a preacher talking about the gospel in such a way that somebody's little world comes to an end, but they experience a redemptive possibility. They've wrestled with alcoholism, but through their faith they saw a new hope. You're talking about a kind of demythologized eschatology, little worlds ending every moment. Now, Macquarie, existentialist as he is, loves demythologized eschatology. In fact, he is content. He knows some problems. It's too individualistic, but he's content to let it rest there. I disagree. As a matter of fact, demythologized eschatology has some virtues, but I think it is finally a sellout of the gospel. And my main objection to demythologized eschatology is that it cannot deal with real tragedy. Let me say what I mean. Eschatological moments of renewal that keep on happening at the existential level are wonderful, and they do happen as far as they go. But what about the truly unfixable moments in life? What about a crib death? What about tormenting cancer that will not yield to radiation and becomes more savage every day? What about the poor, whom, as Jesus said, we have always with us? It's an unfixable problem. What about the women raped and murdered as a tactic of war in Bosnia? What about all of the efforts for righteousness and peace that are lost and wasted? Demythologized eschatology is so anchored in the present that it cannot deal with radical tragedy and evil. It is, in effect, a theological version of secular progress. Namely, the resources for things improving can be found entirely at hand. And I want to say that in the Christian church, progress is not our most important product. We do not believe in progress in the Christian faith. We believe in hope, and there is a distinct difference. Hope is a deep-seated trust that even when the resources are not at hand in the present tense, that God can be counted on to be redemptive and merciful. As Christopher Lash says in his book, Progress and Its Critics, people who believe in hope, unlike those who believe in progress, are always prepared for the worst. Now, all of this is on the way to articulating a fourth view, which is my own. Not my own, but one that I think is more biblically faithful and satisfying. A fourth understanding of eschatology is, I don't know the language to use, but I'm going to call it eschatology in the future present tense. Eschatology in the future present tense. Eschatology in the future present tense begins by making a claim about the future that bars and pulls no punches. Namely this, the world really will end in the glory of God. No holds barred. The world, like the futuristic eschatology, yes, the world really will end in the future of God. That's what is meant in the images of the New Testament, that the Son of Man will come on the cloud and all the tribes of the earth will mourn. Now, those are poetic and metaphorical images, but to call them poetic and metaphorical is not to say that they simply operate at the level of the imagination. They refer to an event that human language cannot describe, but faith claims genuinely will occur. As Flannery O'Connor once said about the Eucharist, it's a symbol. But if it is only a symbol, then the hell with it. It's more than just a symbol. These images of the parousia are signs of a central and genuine conviction of the Christian faith. The Alpha of God's good creation is moving inevitably toward the Omega of God's good consummation. George Caird put it this way. He said, look, the biblical writers really did believe that the world would come to an end. But they also used that language of the end to describe events in the middle of history that they knew very well were not the end, like the fall of Jerusalem, which meant that they somehow saw import for this claim about the end in the present. All right. Having said that about the future then, eschatology in the future present tense has to say something also about the present. There's a colleague at Princeton of mine named Don Jewell. He's a New Testament scholar, and he's very committed to the church. And one of the things that he likes to do is to teach Bible studies to junior highs. Well, he had a group of junior highs that he was taking through a several-week Bible study, and there was one kid in the group who was absolutely bored out of his gourd with everything Don had to say. He sat in the corner, he looked out the window, he scratched his stomach, he yawned, he paid no attention whatsoever. Well, one day, Don was talking about that eschatological scene in the Gospel of Mark when Jesus is baptized, and the text says, the heavens were ripped apart, schizo, same word as schizophrenic. The heavens were ripped apart. And Don said, you know what that means? That means that God has made a hole in the heavenly curtain, and we now can have access to God. We can get to God. Suddenly, the kid who hadn't said anything in weeks, who'd been bored out of his gourd, spoke up. That ain't what it means. That isn't what it means? No, that's not what it means. That doesn't mean that we can get to God. That means that God can get to us. God is loose in the world and nothing is safe. Eschatology in the future present tense says the God of the future is loose in the present and nothing is safe. Now, we need to be careful here. If futuristic eschatology didn't say enough about the present, and realized and demythologized eschatology said too much about the present, we need a very careful kind of balance here, but it won't do simply to say something lame like the already and the not yet are in creative tension. We've got to take a step farther with hesitation and trepidation. We've got to say more than that. How is the God of the future in the present? How is God present in a future present tense? There's this wonderful scene in Tom Stoppard's play, The Real Thing. A husband and wife are having one of these conversations that is superficially playful, but underneath is very treacherous. He is badgering her about whether she's been faithful to him in their marriage. Have you ever taken a lover? Please, you can go ahead. We're adults here. Have you ever taken a lover? Finally, he badgers her to the point that she blurts out the truth. Yes. He's stunned, but he tries to be brave. Well, how many? I mean, roughly, how many? 9. 9? Gosh. Do you feel betrayed? She said. Surprised. I thought we had a commitment. There are no commitments, she said. Only bargains. Well, that's an interesting distinction, isn't it? Bargains and commitments? A bargain is a deal. Hey, you paint my house, I'll pay you $1,000. That's a bargain. A commitment, on the other hand, is a promise. With a bargain, all you have is the contract and the money. With a commitment, what you have is me. The one who makes a commitment makes a promise. And in the promise is the presence of the one who makes it. That's the difference. That's the only guarantee to a commitment, is the trustworthiness and presence of the one who promises. Theologian Christopher Morse has argued this is precisely the point about New Testament eschatology. The word about God's future comes into the present as a promise. And the God who makes that promise is present in that promise, making a commitment to you. The God who is present as promise maker, future present tense. How does that God work in the present? We can make a long list here, but I'm not. I'm going to make 2 suggestions of metaphors. The first of these is that God is present as an axe. And the second is that God is present as a servant. Now, both of those are eschatological images. First of all, the axe is laid at the root of the tree. Now, that's good news, because what that means is the God of the future who is present will allow no human institution that does not fulfill the will of God to endure. Now, that's great news about totalitarian governments, oppressive forces, evil and corruption in the world. But let me tell you, it is also good news about seemingly decent institutions like schools, marriage, social welfare, seemingly good government. The root of the axe is laid against that tree even so. As Karl Barth said, grace is the enemy of everything. Even the most indispensable interim ethic. Do you remember in Flannery O'Connor's story, Revelation, when Ms. Turpin, respectable good citizen, catches that eschatological vision and the world has turned upside down and she sees herself and her husband going up into heaven with her face shocked because even her virtue was being burned away. The God of the future will not allow any partial human creation to stand. The second is servant. Now, servant can be domesticated into a kind of tame image. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. Nice guy. It's an eschatological image. And Frederick Herzog puts it better when he says, the Son of Man came not to be waited on, but to wait on. Waiting on. God is present, waiting on you, waiting on me, waiting on the world. Notice the temporal pressure of waiting on. I read, I don't know where now, a story about a father and his daughter who were extremely close when she was young. They were very, and the time that they knew how close they were most especially was when they would have a family gathering and someone inevitably would pull out the old Victrola and put on polka music and members of the family would dance. And when they put on the beer barrel polka, the father would walk over to the daughter, take her by the hand and say, I believe this is our dance. And they would dance around the room to the beer barrel polka. Well, she grew up. She got to be a teenager, and you know how teenagers are. And so on one of those occasions when the beer barrel polka was on and he came over and took her hand, she pulled it. You leave me alone. Don't touch me, she she said, out of some adolescent funk. And he respected it. He never again asked her to dance. As she got to be an older teenager, the separation between them grew. She would come home late from a date. He'd be asleep in a bathrobe in the easy chair with a book fallen at his feet. And she would come into the door and he would wake up and she'd say, "What do you think you're doing?" And he would say, "I'm just waiting on you." Well, finally, she left home with great relief. But as she became an adult, she matured, and she began to miss her father. And so on one family occasion when she was home, and somebody pulled out the Victrola, and the beer barrel polka began to play, she sucked in her breath and walked across the room and tapped her father on the shoulder and said, "I believe this is our dance." And he turned and said, "I've been waiting on you. I've been waiting on you. For the Son of Man came not to be waited on, but to wait on us." Now, very briefly, what does it mean when we gather all these threads together about the kind of preaching that we do? Three quick things. First of all, it means that we do not ever stand in the pulpit again and reduce the gospel to the power of positive thinking. We do not preach the possibility gospel. We do not look at life and try to find a silver lining. We do not face situations like Oklahoma City and scour around in the rubble of human tragedy to try to find something to make people feel better about the possibilities that are there. We offer no explanations. We offer only the promises of the future present God who is committed to us. As Christopher Morse again has put it, what faith confesses to hear in the gospel is a promise only God can keep, that even when the worst things come upon us that can possibly happen, they will not be able to prevent Christ coming to us and to all the world in redemption and ultimate reclaiming from all harm. The second thing is, we encourage from the pulpit the Christian community to engage in an ethic of reform when that is possible. But when that is impossible, we encourage the Christian community to engage in an ethic of defiance. That is to say, a looking of the powers of oppression in the eye and a refusal to cooperate. Defiance. That's what it means, by the way, when Jesus says, "Turn the other cheek." When Jesus says, "Turn the other cheek," it isn't be a Mr. Nice Guy. When Jesus says, "Turn the other cheek," what that does is to rob the oppressor of his victim. It is to say, today you have the power to commit violence against me, but I do not belong to today. I belong to tomorrow. And tomorrow, violence will be obsolete. So take what you must today. You will not take my confidence about tomorrow. In one of her books, Mary Lou Wiseman describes a 15-year-old boy dying of an incurable disease. And just before his death, he asked his father to arrange him in the hospital bed in an impudent position. I think that describes, in a sense, the church that hopes. Arrange us in regard to the powers of death all around us in an impudent position. Finally, in terms of biblical preaching, we will refuse to reduce any biblical text to worldly wisdom. They can be done, you know. We can take the eschatological promise of the gospel and we can cut the legs right off of it and turn it into a kind of sage form of preaching. Take, for example, that wonderful story in the Gospel of Luke about Jesus and the 10 lepers. You remember it. Jesus is walking along the fault line between Samaria and Galilee, and suddenly he encounters 10 lepers. They appeal for mercy, and he says, "Go show yourselves to the priest." And on the way to the priest, they're all cleansed, healed. Broken flesh becomes whole. For 9 of the lepers, that's the last we hear of them. They disappear off the pages of Luke, off the pages of history. They're gone from sight. We don't know what happened to them, whether they became respectable. Maybe they grew up to be rabbis. Who knows? Only one, a Samaritan, carried the story any further as he came back and said, thank you. Now, you can take that text, if you want to, and squeeze it into a little wisdom. Friends, we should always be the kind of people who are grateful in life, who say thank you when something good happens to us, especially when it comes from God. Let's sing the doxology now as we all say thank you to God. You can do that if you want to. But look at the text in context. It comes in a fabulously eschatological section in Luke. In fact, the very next pericope is a discussion about the kingdom of God, in which Jesus says, the kingdom of God is not coming with signs to be observed. The kingdom of God is among you, future, present, tense. Right before the passage about the lepers, there's this odd statement of Jesus to the disciples in which he says, if your slave comes in from plowing the field, do you say to the slave, come on to the dinner table and have supper? No. You say, fix my supper. And when the slave has done his chores, do you say to the slave, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you for what you have done? No. The slave has just done what the slave is supposed to do. He's only done his duty. You don't say thank you then. Oh, really? In other words, the conditions under which somebody would say thank you are not when a slave has just done the slave's duty, but when something extraordinary has happened. 9 lepers have no need to say thank you because their slave, Jesus, has just done his duty. Answer my prayer. Heal me. Make my life good. That's God's job. And you don't say thank you when a slave just does his job. But the one leper who was a Samaritan, and it was probably because he was a Samaritan, recognized that something extraordinary had spilled into his life, not from the present, but from the future. And he returned in response to that extraordinary grace to say thank you, because he had not been served by a slave. He had been waited on by the Son of Man. Eschatology. And if we stand and proclaim it, one day, I promise you, the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. Thank you for your attention.
We have a few moments. Questions, comments. Don.
Thank you, first of all, for your devotedness to the text of Scripture and take to Jesus. One thing that we kind of deal with in our church, we divide threat, promise, law, and gospel, and we get the little tension of some people we say are teaching gospel and trying to cover over the law. And you mentioned the acts and the servant, and I'm kind of putting those together. You really have an eschatology without the acts, without the law, without the good threat.
Do I have an eschatology without the axe?
Is there that punch in that eschatology without an axe? Does it become mushy, mystical?
By the way, the axe and the servant, the axe and the one who waits on, are not the only images that we could use, but I actually picked those because of their plus-minus quality, their kind of working-together quality. The axe has a kind of eschatological threat about it. It has a sort of a destructive edge about it. the servant who waits on has a more positive kind of loving and merciful quality to it. But maybe this is my Reformed tradition responding here. I find law and gospel in both of those. I don't think the axe is the law and the servant who waits is the gospel. I think it is really good news that the institutions of this world, that the world thinks are permanent, are coming under the chopping power of the axe of God. So I don't see that as utterly law in the negative sense of it. I see it as gospel as well, even though it has a kind of breaking down the powers that that be. Now, am I speaking to your question at all?
Well, I guess my question is, if you remove any of the edge to it, any of the threat, have you really lost the servant to God?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think that is what is wrong with demythologized eschatology. Demythologized eschatology is fine when it's dealing with positive growth experiences, but it is not fine when suddenly a woman has been brutalized, raped, and killed. What do you say about that in terms of eschatological moments and growth experiences? This is an utter tragedy. And what you have to say is that in the final analysis, every tear will be dried and death and pain will be no more, and this act of violence will not be validated by God's future. That's why I think we have that tough talk in the New Testament. It is not that God is opposed in a destructive and cannibalistic sense toward human nature. It's that whatever it is going on in human society that opposes the will of God, thank God it will be consumed in a kind of fire, to use that biblical imagery. And yes, eschatology needs that edge if it's going to be hopeful, truly hopeful.
A question from Mr. Eschatology, Jeffrey Gibbs.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I used to call them myself, they're going to be parousia problems. That is, crippling and the effects of sin and sin itself, the result of which will only be removed when the Son of Man comes on the clouds of heaven on the last day. And that can give a Lutheran church and a Christian pastor an eschatological edge. If you listen to your people and go down into those places with them, then
right.
You know there is nothing, there is no hope in the gospel.
You said it far better than I could. In Dante's Inferno, in addition to the famous "Abandon hope, all ye who enter," as the sign over the last circle of hell, there's an interesting line: "To lose hope is to live out of desire." Now, I think what Dante is talking about is the suburbs there. That when you lose eschatological hope, desire becomes the primary way you organize your life, and your Bermuda and Zoysia grass becomes much more important than death in the inner city.
And that's why it's much better to get camel facing the eyes of you.
There's a mysterious thing, if I remember.
Anything else? We thank you.
Pleasure.